Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Kate Stetson for the petitioners. We are here on a very narrow issue, and we submit a very textbook Chevron Step 1 issue. The EPA in this case took a specific and time-limited statutory exemption, and it turned it into an indefinite, open-ended regulatory exemption.
Can we start, at least for me, with your standing?
Sure.
As I understand it, you need to show that some of the plants that were commenced in 2008 or 2009 would shut down. And where is that? How do we know that?
We can point to a couple things, Judge Kavanaugh. And first, you're right, just to take a step back for a minute and set the table on the standing issue. The issue that EPA has raised repeatedly in its brief is singular, and that is redressability. So injury is conceded, causation is conceded. The sole issue, both that interveners and EPA raise, is redressability. What we would point to at that point becomes the numbers that are actually in the record. If you look at EPA's regulatory impact analysis, and this is specifically, I would direct you to Joint Appendix 1160, and 1167. What EPA points to is capacity online as of late 2009, which is when the NRIA was performed. I think it was published in March 2010. At that point, there was 12 billion gallons of capacity online. We also have the declaration of Carl Simon that observes that the capacity that we're talking about, the capacity of these particular plants that are, we argue, not subject to this indefinite deemed compliant exemption, is 300 million gallons of capacity. The entire redressability argument that EPA makes turns on the math that Mr. Simon performs in his declaration.
Well,
and that...
Keep going, and then I'll...
With respect to that, what Mr. Simon says is, we've looked at some of the numbers, we've conducted more studies, we've examined a sample of certain ethanol plants, we've extrapolated that out a little bit further, and what we've concluded is if you add all these things together and you take away some of the plants that might appear to be idled or deemed compliant, what you have is just around a little over 15 billion gallons of capacity. But, of course, that's not what the record actually says. And more to your point, Judge Kavanaugh, in the record, including at record 2363 of the administrative record, we have ag processing saying exactly this: loss of RIN generating capacity would consign a renewable fuel plant to the scrap heap. That is a direct attestation by one of the renewable fuel operators that if these plants, if these operators aren't entitled to the RIN numbers, which is the way that they participate in this market, they are no longer going to be operational.
But couldn't they retrofit to, couldn't the 2008-2009 plants, and I might be getting this wrong, but my understanding was that they could retrofit and therefore get the benefit and therefore comply with the 20% requirement, and therefore nothing would really change from your client's perspective?
Well, to begin with, EPA acknowledged that, this is Joint Appendix 392, this is the final rule, that retrofitting would be difficult if not impossible.
Yeah, it was hard to tell from that. I agree, that's a great sentence for you, I agree, but it's hard to tell from that whether they're referring to just the 2008-2009 plants or to the 2007 and earlier plants as well, but it at least includes probably the 2008.
That's true. I mean, it might cut into a broader set, but it presumably at least would include the 2008 and 2009 plants. And if you look to it, the entire purpose of what we say is this sort of hyper-extended indefinite regulatory exemption, EPA's stated policy reason, such as it is that it means to protect investment. This is a market that was essentially government-created. This mandate is government-created. The ethanol industry is government-created. So if an ethanol plant can't participate in this particular renewable fuels market, it is, as the ag processing folks said, going to take its plant offline. That is expressly stated in the record. The fact that not all of these $300 million of capacity might be taken offline, I don't think defeats our standing. It's enough to show, as EPA appears to have conceded, that it would be difficult, if not impossible, for some of these plants to be taken offline. Once you get past that redressability point, and once you get past the sort of mathematical back and forth that the redressability point reduces to, we think the merits are very straightforward. What the statute says is, for calendar years 2008 and 2009, there's no embellishment to that. There's no indefinite exemption attached to that. It's quite plain. And what EPA attempts to do in its brief is to leap straight to Chevron Step 2. But as this court has said repeatedly, before an agency gets the benefit of a Chevron Step 2 inquiry, the court has to stop at Chevron Step 1. And Chevron Step 1 is read the statute. What the statute says is for calendar years 2008 and 2009.
Would it be possible for a plant that was commenced in 2008 to be done by the end of 2009?
As a technical or engineering matter, I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor.
If not, then the exemption looks like it was, under your theory, for a null set.
No, I don't think it's a null set.
It has to be a plant that's commenced in 08 or 09, correct?
That's correct. But construction commenced is subject to a particular definition. It doesn't need to be completed by the
end of 2009. I understand that, but if for the exemption to matter, it will have to be completed and operating by the end of 09.
Right, correct.
It'd have to be commenced later than January 1st or starting on January 1st, 08 and finished and up and running by December 31 of 09, and I don't know if that's feasible or not. I think it might be.
I'm going to resist that point. I mean, under the EPA's definition, it wouldn't matter at all.
Under yours, yeah, that's what I'm getting at. Is it absurd to interpret the statute as you do? This is the backdrop for my question, in the sense that it wouldn't make any sense to create an exemption for 2 years if no plant that was commenced in 08 or 09 could actually be done by the end of 09.
Right. To be frank, Judge Kavanaugh, I don't know the answer to your question. I suspect that's because EPA never argued that. EPA has never said that to interpret this particular statute in this way would lead to a null set. The one or one and a half, if you give it leeway, thing that EPA said in its original rule was that as a policy matter, it wouldn't make sense to permit these plants an exemption for 2 years and then take it away, because they view that as not being sufficiently protective as investment. The half, I would add, is the, I'm sorry, Judge Henderson.
Okay, I read this sentence a different way. I read the first sentence that for 2008, if a plant is built after December 19th of 07, it has to meet the 20%. The second sentence says for 2008 and 2009, a plant that's fired with either the natural gas or biomass or a combination is deemed in compliance whenever it was built. I mean, it says any ethanol plant. So where does it come from that it's limited to those built after December 31st of 07, or were there no ethanol plants fired with biomass or natural gas or a combination before that date?
I think where this comes from, Judge Henderson, is the relationship between the other grandfathering statute and this one. And we explain in our brief that there is a point to which EPA's logic holds, which is there'd be no reason for any exemption. If this only applied to plants construct or for which construction commenced before December 19th, 2007. So in order to give this statute any meaning, you have to assign some set of construction or of plants for which construction was commenced after December 19th, 07, and before the end of 09. That is, I think, a fair reading of the statute. That's one on which we agree. Where we part ways is the effect of that exemption.
Okay, so the phrase, any ethanol plant, in the second sentence of 7545 note, you're saying means any ethanol plant constructed after December 31st of 07 by virtue of another provision.
Yes, because the other provision takes care, grandfathers all of the previously constructed plants. That's the reason. There is some additional leeway given to plants that were constructed in that time frame. The problem that we have is that the leeway is time limited. It's meant only to exempt those particular plants for two calendar years, not the indefinite exemption that EPA created.
Let me just ask you, if an ethanol plant is fired the way it's supposed to be fired, to be deemed in compliance, was built before December 31st of 07. How long is this exemption?
If it was built before December, and I believe it's December 19th of 07 is the operative date of the statute, if it's built before 07, the exemption is indefinite. That's the grandfathering, sort of the whole grandfathering statute. What EPA did was essentially take this separate transition rule and say, we're going to shoehorn it into that other indefinite exemption by virtue of this idea that it couldn't possibly be that these particular plants would only be subject to an exemption from the 20% emissions requirement for those 2 years. Otherwise, investments would get overturned and so forth. Now, to get back, Judge Kavanaugh, to your question about the text, there was, I want to mention, one additional sort of quasi-textual analysis that EPA put forward in support of this rule. It wasn't the one that Judge Kavanaugh mentioned. It came after we sought review, and it came in the form of a rather elaborate hypothesis about the difference between plants and fuel. We submit that the statute is quite plain on its face. There is no ambiguity about the phrase for calendar years 2008 and 2009. So even if you are inclined to indulge that late-breaking ambiguity argument, we again would submit that EPA can't make use of that until you get past Chevron Step 1, and Chevron Step 1 supplies the answer here.
Because in the first sentence, only if it achieves, it modifies what?
In the first sentence, so this is, you're looking at the transition rule 210A sub 1, only if it achieves modifies the fuel.
Okay, and then the second sentence, the plant is deemed to be in compliance.
Correct. That's correct. But even, even under EPA's sort of elaborate ambiguity argument about fuels and plants and fuels, EPA would still have to read fuel into the second sentence for its interpretation to make sense. So this entire sort of sideshow of a construct about ambiguity doesn't even read on what for calendar years 2008 and 2009 means.
I mean, there's no separation between the fuel deemed in compliance and the plant that's producing it deemed in compliance.
No, not for purposes of this statute, no. It's quite clear what the statute suggests, and it's EPA's sort of post hoc justification of finding ambiguity lurking elsewhere in the statute that it's trying to seize on, but there really is no ambiguity as to this. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Durkee?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Dan Durkee from the U.S. Department of Justice, and with me at council table, we have Roland Dubois from EPA's Office of General Counsel, and Mr. Quinn and Sproom from the interveners who will argue separately. I think we should start with standing, Your Honor. The question, as posed by petitioners and by Judge Kavanaugh, would some plants shut down? I submit that's not even the right question. I think you have to step back further, because the injury here that they assert is not that some sliver of industry that's deemed compliant is going to shut down or going to continue to operate. Their injury is that corn prices are more expensive.
Right, but that depends then on some plants shutting down, doesn't it?
Well, corn is a global commodity. The price of corn depends on a lot of things.
Obvious, but if you take away a big chunk of demand from the plants shutting down, that in turn is going to affect the prices. That's the theory, as I...
Well, that is a possible theory, and...
And EPA itself acknowledged, as Ms. Stetson said, that it would be difficult and not impossible for some of these plants to retrofit, so they'd have to shut down.
But that doesn't mean that it's going to affect either the demand on the corn supply or, to take the next step, what the actual corn price is that that food processors are facing, because they're speculating that the plants that have made this investment and are deemed compliant, if they lose their ability to generate RINs and right. participate in the program, that they're going to stop producing.
Right, and that would affect the price.
There's two steps, neither of which they have any evidence for. They haven't put any facts or affidavits of any sort. The court's precedents are very clear about what the burden is on a petitioner to show standing.
I find the standing issue very complicated, so I want to separate it out. Sorry about this. Okay, on the plants shutting down part, do you agree that some plants commenced in 08 or 09 would shut down if required to comply with the 20% requirement?
It's all we know is that it is possible. We don't know if they would or not. We don't know if they would continue. There's other reasons why.
Do you agree that it would be difficult, if not impossible, for at least some of those plants commenced in 08 or 09 to retrofit?
At least some, yes. That's in the record.
Okay.
What's not in the record is...
Now explain. Okay, so I'm past that one now. On the effect on the market, you have an argument about the 15 billion gallons issue.
Right.
And I need you to explain that to
me. The 15 billion gallons, it's only one part. It's not our only standing argument. It's only one piece of the pie. The 15 billion gallons comes in terms of what's going to happen in the marketplace if this sliver of industry is no longer deemed compliant. The first step is, well, what are those plants going to do? Are they still going to buy corn? Are they still going to produce ethanol, even if it's not deemed compliant? That's speculation. Even if they're taken out, there's if we step back, the way the program is set up is renewable fuels, different types of renewable fuels can generate these RINs, R-I-N-s. And you get, depending on what kind of fuel you have, what kind of RIN you generate is how you participate in the program. So refineries and obligated parties, they have to buy up these RINs, which represent renewable fuel. Only a certain amount of RINs can be from corn, starch, ethanol. There's a required volume, and some of it has to be advanced biofuel, some of it has to be other types of biofuel that corn, starch, ethanol doesn't qualify for. So there's a limited amount of RINs from corn, starch, ethanol that qualify.
It's 15 billion gallons.
The maximum is 15 billion gallons, right.
Okay, and how do you know in advance whether you're going to get one of those 15 billion gallons if you're a producer? Well, is that what the RIN process is?
Well, EPA approves what they call pathways.
Right.
So EPA looks at the entire greenhouse gas, the life cycle greenhouse gas emissions for a certain pathway, the step-by-step process of how you're going to produce a certain type of fuel, and says, well, this will qualify for a certain type of RIN because we think it'll reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 20%. Or it'll reduce by 50% and it uses biomass, and so it'll qualify for a different kind of RIN.
How the deemed compliant ones qualify?
The deemed compliant ones qualify based on the terms of the statute, that it's only ethanol plants, and it's only ethanol plants that commence construction in this window of time. Mm-hmm. And that are fired by gas or biomass. So it's defined in terms of the plant's characteristics.
Okay. I'm sorry if this question sounds like I'm uncertain about this, but that would be accurate. Okay, so the 15 billion gallons, could that be taken up solely by plants commenced in 2010 and later?
Well, what we say is that 15 billion gallons could be taken up solely by plants that commenced before ESA. That's our argument, is that those plants that were already...
Could be, though.
Could, well, that...
They challenge your math on that.
They challenge our math by pointing to an estimate that was in the final rule that EPA issued, which is concededly an estimate. They just want you to ignore the more recent analysis of the actual data that these plants submit. That's what the Simon affidavit did, is it looked at the permitting numbers that came into EPA and the database that EPA created based on these registrations and said, well, now we've got a better set of information. What is that telling us?
Let me ask one more question. Sorry. Plants that were, let's call them 07 and earlier,
right.
They're producing ethanol, right?
Right.
Then we have the 08 and 09 plants.
Right.
Then we have the 10 and later plants.
Right.
How do you know, if you have one of those plants, that you're going to get within the 15 billion gallons? Maybe you already answered that.
Well, if you're...
In other words, maybe you're producing more than you need to produce, and no one's certain that they're going to actually get within this program. And what's the effect of getting within the program?
Well, the effect of getting within the program is that you can generate these RINs that people will buy, which has value.
Okay.
How you know is, if you're... Well, you know when you start. Let's say you're an ethanol plant. You start before 2007. So you know you're grandfathered because the statute says that.
Do you know you're getting within the 15 billion?
Well, the amount you're grandfathered for is based on a base volume. You can't just in 2010
right.
start producing twice as much or three times as much.
Does the government kind of chalk everyone up from different plants, and then when you get to 15 billion, everyone else is out of luck?
Well, it's based on capacity. We estimate how much we think is out there. What the production capacity is that's out there that could qualify to generate these RINs. So we say, based on what these plants have reported, we know when they started, and we know what they can produce, and you add it up, and it's over 15 billion mm-hmm. gallons, actually. Now, there might be others that could produce more. They could generate RINs, too, and then it's a question of the market. Well, maybe you can sell your RINs cheaper. Maybe, you know, let's say this industry, let's say all these early plants, all these pre-2007 plants, maybe they were able to produce 20 billion gallons
right.
versus RINs. Well, only 15 can participate. So that extra 5 billion gallons, there's still RINs out there. They're still on the marketplace. Somebody might or might not buy them. Maybe they'll sell them cheaper. Maybe they'll export the fuel. Maybe they don't need the RINs. Maybe that fuel has a market value independent of this program, and there's a foreign market that they can export their ethanol. So they might still go ahead and produce 20 billion gallons. This program only creates a market for 15 billion gallons of that.
Your theory is that if the deemed compliant rules exemptions vacated, the total amount of produced ethanol will stay the same.
Yes, I think that's right, because there's...
That's your theory.
That's our theory, because, let me say this. They haven't, it's their burden, and they haven't done anything to disprove that.
Theory is a little, doesn't make a whole lot of common sense, because you would think if some plants shut down that there's going to be less ethanol produced.
Well, see, that's not the case. It's reasonable to assume that's not the case, because we know that there's this grandfathered capacity to produce at least 15 billion, and they can sell, they can participate in the program, and they know they can participate in the program. The problem with the petitioner's argument is each step is speculative. They say, well, if the plant can't be deemed compliant, they're going to shut down. They're not going to participate at all. That's one speculation.
Supported by EPA, I might add, but go to two.
To some extent. Some will. We didn't say every plant would shut down, and they certainly haven't shown that. Two is, if those plants shut down, and so you take that slice out of corn buying, mm-hmm. corn purchasing facilities out of the marketplace, is somebody else going to be buying that corn? Well, there's all these grandfathered plants that have the capacity to produce the maximum that this program allows. And we're not just talking about, well, what's the corn market in general? What's the global commodity market? That's not really what's relevant. What's relevant is, what did EPA do? Is it EPA's decision to give this sliver of industry an exemption that's affecting people buying the corn? And we say, no, that's speculation, because there's billions and billions of capacity out there that can participate in the program, that can buy the corn to make the ethanol and get the credit for it. So I think it's more reasonable to assume that they're going to use that, because there's a market created to buy the RINs. You're taking some players out. Why wouldn't some other people step in to that that gap and sell their ethanol. Because they're already grandfathered, there's nothing stopping them. They have the production capacity and they have the market. And then the third speculation is, well, let's say nobody steps in. How's that going to affect the price of corn? Because again, that is their injury. And the court's precedents are very clear that you have to tie redressability to injury. It's not just that deemed compliant plants are going to stop buying corn, because that's not they're not hurt by deemed compliant plants buying corn or not buying corn. They're very clear in their brief and in the reply that their injury is that the price of corn is rising, not because of deemed compliant, not because of the sliver. The price of corn is rising because of the program. The entire
renewable fuel. They say both, I think.
Well, they try and marry those two up, but I don't think they do, because their injury is
that
corn.
The third one, how would you prove it?
How would you prove that the price of corn would?
You would say there are going to be fewer people buying corn, therefore the price is likely.
Well, if that were true, if overall there were fewer, but they don't even try and make that showing. They just say, well, this handful of plants that fit within this exemption are going to stop buying corn. They don't even try and address all the other market players, even in the ethanol industry or for corn in general. And that's where we started with, was their injury is the price of corn. And they say, if you take away the deemed compliant exemption, then you're assuming that those plants will not buy corn. But they never try and marry that up with, well, what's that going to do to the price of corn? And I don't think they can, and it's their burden.
Can I ask you a question? If all we're left with is the grandfathered ethanol plants from pre-07, did you say that there's some restriction on their expanding their capacity? I thought you did.
Yes. Yeah, just because you're grandfathered doesn't mean that you can produce as much as you want. There's a baseline volume that is based on the last 5 years of production. So,
can they do what you? I thought I heard you say that they could then use more RINs or can they do that?
Yeah, can they expand? They can. Well, the capacity that EPA estimates, I think, is over 16.5 billion, and even with the conservative assumption of how much could be produced by these deemed compliant plants that you take out, you're still well over 15 billion. Now, could a grandfathered plant expand it dramatically beyond that? Well, no, they wouldn't be grandfathered. And if they made a major modification or if they went beyond their baseline volume, no, they couldn't go that far. They would lose their exemption because it's not open-ended in that sense.
But it's open-ended enough for them to increase the RIN volume.
Well, the EPA didn't need to go to that point because the production, the stated capacity in the database was already well over 16 billion gallons, and so that was more than could participate in the program, even if you take out the most conservative estimate of what these deemed compliant plants were. That's the math.
If that's true, what's the point of this indefinite exemption if you don't need more capacity?
Well, I think that's a fair question of why Congress gave this exemption in the first place. What were they trying to protect? And as I think Judge Henderson was asking, it's 2007, Congress is enacting this statute. You've got plants that are already online, plants that have quote-unquote commenced construction. Well, they're grandfathered. They're not a problem. You've got plants that are, let's say, in the pipeline. They're not ready. They haven't commenced construction. They're not going to be grandfathered, but they're at some stage in the pipeline. They're going to start in, let's say, 2008 or 2009. What do you do with those plants? And that's what the transition rule speaks to, is the narrow set of ethanol plants fired by natural gas or biomass that commence in that narrow window of time, 2008, 2009. Now, is that a null set or is not that a null set? And it turns out there are plants that do commence in that time frame. And that's what the Simon affidavit talked about, is how much are they producing? We know they're producing about 300 million gallons, and you know, based on some extrapolations, we think they can produce up to maybe 950 million gallons. But there are plants that fall within that deemed compliant exception. And to transition to the statutory argument, the question is, well, what did Congress want to do with those? Did it make sense that Congress would say, those plants that are in the pipeline that are not ready to be grandfathered, but we're going to make them exempt. Well, are we going to make them exempt for a year of operation, and then under petitioner's theory they have to close down?
No, they'd have to retrofit.
If they can. But see, petitioners can't have it both ways. They can't say, well, they're going to shut down or they're not going to shut down. We don't know.
I get the tension on the standing, but right. If we're on merits now, I think the
right.
Point was the statute, to match up to your reading, the statute should have said for ethanol plants that commence construction in 2008-2009. Instead, it says for calendar years 2008-2009. It's not as if the commence construction phrase was somehow foreign to Congress, because it's in the sentence before and it's in the earlier section that talks about the 12-1907 date. So
absolutely.
The missing commence construction in that second sentence is a big omission for your merits position.
That's entirely true, but the same is true for petitioners. They're missing the word fuel. Congress clearly knew how to say in the sentence right before it, fuel from ethanol.
It also talked fuel from facilities that commence construction. So fuel wasn't used in isolation. Fuel from facilities that commence construction.
That's what they said in the first sentence, but they didn't say that in the second sentence. Mm-hmm. So I think the same criticism could be made of petitioner's argument. Well, Congress surely knew how to say fuel from ethanol plants that are fired by natural gas that commence construction in 2008 is exempt. Mm-hmm. But they didn't say that. So the Chevron step one argument is there are different words. They can't dispute, petitioners can't dispute, there are different words. Plants on the one hand and fuel on the other.
Sure, they're different words, but what difference does that make in terms of meaning?
Well, if we say that's enough to create an ambiguity, and that gets you to Chevron step two. Now, it's not true that it's not true that any word difference will create an ambiguity. Chevron step one isn't that broad. But I think there's a real difference for the reason for the reason you just said, Judge Kavanaugh, is they knew how to say it one way, clearly, and they knew how to say it the other way, clearly, and yet they chose this very awkward construction that doesn't really fit in either. Well, I think that's an ambiguity. That's an ambiguity that demands interpretation. It's also...
But not when the point of both sentences is whether they're within this 20% reduction or not. And you don't have a plant that's deemed in compliance and its fuel is not, and you don't have fuel that's deemed in compliance from a plant that's not.
That is true. It's the fuel. When you get down to it, it's the fuel that's deemed in compliance. It's hard to explain how a plant would be deemed in compliance absent the fuel, because what we're really talking about is the fuel generating.
They're clearly referring to the fuel from the plant.
And yet they didn't use those words. And
right.
What does
it
that
doesn't
mean?
Really create.
Well, I think it. I think it does create an ambiguity, because I think you have to ask, well, what, Congress is presumed to use words on purpose. And I think it's a fair question to ask, well, why did they phrase it this way? What did they mean? Was there something else they were trying to do? And I think that's a fair...
Well, this was no doubt a heavily negotiated compromise with people on both sides. And it looks like people were concerned about an indefinite extension into the future. At the same time, people were concerned about giving the plants built in 08 and 09 some time to get their act together in terms of complying with what was necessary. And so it gives you 2 years to retrofit, or since you're still in the process of building, 2 years to alter the construction to get it in shape so that you can meet the 20% requirement. Isn't that a fair reading?
That is certainly a permissible reading, but I submit that
it's not
that
the unambiguous one.
Exactly. We're talking about step two now, and that's where EPA is entitled to deference, because it's an equally fair reading that Congress didn't want to pull the rug out from under these plants, these ethanol
they didn't.
Plants.
Boy, what a botch. Seriously.
We'd
have to assume some real malpractice, which I don't assume malpractice usually when I see language like this. I assume compromise.
It's a fair point. It's difficult language. It's not the only difficult language in the statute. The fact that the grandfather provision is not even in the transition rule, you have to look back to the actual statute for the grandfather provision that says if you're pre-enactment, you're grandfathered, and then you have to go to the transition rule to say, oh, but for 2008, you're not grandfathered, and then you have to look further to say, oh, but if you're an ethanol plant, you are grandfathered, but we're going to call you deemed compliant. It's a very awkward statute, but I have to go back to the court's precedents are very clear on how Chevron step one works. If there's an ambiguity, and we've pointed out to use of words and a structural ambiguity, that the court shouldn't be making those value judgments.
How does the fuel plant thing create any ambiguity that's relevant here?
Because the question is...
If you agree, I think in response to Judge Henderson, we all know what it means. Could have been phrased differently. But how does it create an ambiguity that's relevant to the issue in this case?
Well, because this issue is... You're right, it's clearly going to talk about fuel at bottom. It's talking about fuel, but the issue is, for how long? Is it just the fuel produced during those 2 years, or is it fuel produced at
those
plants? Well,
on that issue, the fuel plant thing is irrelevant.
Not if you assume the reason they said plants is because they want the plant to be compliant, so whatever that plant produces is within the box of exempt. That's at least a permissible reading of why they said plant, because they wanted anything that plant produces, as long as it's still an ethanol plant and it's still an ethanol plant fired by gas or biomass, the plant is compliant, meaning whatever ethanol that plant produces. It's delimited in time. It can't be any ethanol plant. It has to be built in that time window. But once that plant is exempt, that baseline volume from that plant can go on, just like the grandfather volume.
Why would you favor, by giving them an indefinite exemption, the plants built in 08 and 09 and not after that? I mean, would there be any sense that you do it to say, we want to build in these 2 years and we want them built fast and immediately, and you get a permanent exemption if you do. But if you take some more time and you have to get investors together and you go into 2010, you're sunk. I mean,
that is a choice I think Congress did make. They of all the ambiguity in here, one thing that's clear is it talks about 2008, 2009. You can't go past that for a plant that starts in 2010. That would be there's no statutory basis for that.
But you're giving the people who begin in 08 and 09. A permanent exemption, and if you're a little slow, you don't get it.
That's true, but again, I think that's
is there anything in the legislative history that says we really want to encourage people to build these things in the next 24 months?
No, there's not. We have to base the analysis on what Congress could have reasonably been anticipating, and we submit that it's certainly plausible that Congress was willing to extend this benefit to plants that were in the pipeline but weren't quite ready. But the cutoff for when the pipeline closes is the end of 2009.
Go ahead. Do you agree that a plant could be commenced at some time in 08 and finished in 08 or 09?
It could be, sure, at least in 09.
I mean, some references in the EPA thing to how long it takes to get a plant up and running.
The regulations give you 3 years from commencement of construction, so I think that says that's an average or a good estimate of what it takes. But not every plant's going to take 3 years. It could take a year. I would say we're speculating, but it's unlikely that plant's going to come online right away. There's going to be some, if you're not ready at the end of 2007, I mean, yeah, you could be ready on January 1st, but again, this circles back to our merits argument, our reasonableness is, let's say you've got that plant that comes online in 2008. What's that plant going to be able to do? Is it going to be able to produce the deemed compliant fuel for 1 year, maybe a year and a half, and then either shut down or retrofit or do something else? Or is it at least plausible that Congress wanted to let those plants continue?
How many plants were commenced in 08 and 09?
The Carl affidavit is my only source of information for that.
And I read it as five.
There was five that we know claimed the deemed compliant exemption. There was others that it wasn't clear from the information.
How many others?
He said there were five. That we were certain about five that generated 300 million gallons. And then we extrapolated, and then there was another 14 that accounted for 200 million gallons, but that was based on a sampling. So we know there was 19, and then we extrapolated, well, if there was 14 out of this subset that we sampled, what's the entire set going to be? So we extrapolated up from there.
And do we know That's, we probably don't, but do we know if any of those have retrofitted to meet the 20% requirement, even though they weren't necessarily required to by the CEPA rule?
Yeah, I don't think that's in the record. I don't think we know that. I don't think there'd be any incentive for them to, because they can sell their RINs on the market exempt. And I think that's another problem with the standing argument, to go back to where we started, is we don't know what it would take. We don't know who would do it. We don't know how expensive it would be. We've got these kind of generic statements in the record about, well, it would be difficult and some might close and some might, but...
Well, the key generic statement in the record comes from EPA.
But petitioners would have you rely on that, but I don't think that's enough for standing. I don't think it's enough because of the burden that this court has set before petitioners. Cases like Sierra Club from 2002, renal physicians from 2007, wrestling association are very clear about what is the burden for a petitioner like this industry, where they're not the regulated party, and this is a merits question, so it's a summary judgment standard. They don't have a single affidavit. They point to this statement in the record, which it does say what it says, Judge Kavanaugh, but that should not be sufficient, because it doesn't tie their injury to the deemed compliant exemption. It doesn't say that if the deemed compliant exemption is vacated, the price of corn will go down. It doesn't even say that less people will buy the price of corn, which maybe you could make the assumption that the price will go down, but it doesn't say fewer people will buy corn.
Doesn't it all follow?
I don't think so, because
if there are fewer plants, fewer people are buying, price goes down.
Not necessarily. And I think we're trotting the ground we've already trod. But
sorry.
No, it is the standing question: is what do they need to show? And we don't think you could certainly speculate about it. The line of reasoning you set out is certainly fair, but that's not the standing inquiry. The standing inquiry is: have they come up with evidence or affidavits to support it? And that they haven't done. It shouldn't be the court supplying the line of logic. We're well over time and haven't gotten to the other points, but...
All right. You are over the time, but I wanted to ask you just a technical question.
Sure.
What is in the definition of renewable biomass? What is biomass obtained from the immediate vicinity of buildings and other areas regularly occupied by people or of public infrastructure at risk from wildfire? What is that?
Like an example of what that would be?
Mm-hmm.
I cannot.
I figured out everything else. I couldn't figure that out.
I cannot tell you that either.
Okay.
That level of detail with the regulations, I confess, okay. I couldn't give you an example. I could certainly provide one.
That's okay.
After consulting with the EPA, but I cannot stand here answer that question.
All right.
No, I think we've covered everything. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. O'Quinn.
Thank you, Judge Henderson. May it please the court. I think a critical point for the issue of standing is to recognize that RFS2 does not regulate primary conduct. RFS2 does not address how much corn ethanol can be produced. It doesn't regulate how much corn ethanol can be consumed, and it doesn't regulate how much corn feed ends up being used by any ethanol producers, whether it's the grandfathered ones who existed prior to December 19, 2007, whether it's the deemed compliant ones that come into existence in 2008 or 2009, or whether it's other ones that would have to meet the 20% reduction requirement that come into existence in 2010. So that means this case ends up being just like National Wrestling Coaches Association, in which not only is there no evidence in the record to suggest that a single deemed compliant plant would actually stop producing, which is frankly an unreasonable assumption given that each such plant represents something like a $50 million capital investment.
How much does it cost to retrofit?
Judge Kavanaugh, I don't know off the top of my head what it does cost to retrofit.
Given what you just said, isn't that a key number that we would need to know? Because that their theory, supported by EPA, is that some of the plants would shut down, and that presumably would depend on how much it costs to retrofit as opposed to keep going.
Well, Judge Kavanaugh, first, the provision that they cite, and this is at JA 391, 392, yeah, says many of the current technology corn ethanol plants may find it difficult, if not impossible, to retrofit existing plants. Now, first of all, that is the stuff of speculation, and it's their burden to demonstrate redressability and also causation, and interveners challenge their standing on both grounds. It's their burden to prove, and that is the stuff of speculation. Second, it refers to current technology corn ethanol plants. They haven't come forward with any affidavits to suggest that a single deemed compliant plant used nothing but what was then current technology in existence. So whether this statement would apply to the deemed compliant plants or not, I don't know. I don't think they know, and it's their burden in order for this court to find that they have standing. But the other point is, there are literally a half a dozen things, if not more, that deemed compliant plants could do, or that other ethanol plants could do, that would result in the same amount of corn feed being consumed. And that goes to the problem of redressability. I mean, first of all, again, RFS2 doesn't stop anybody from selling corn ethanol. Maybe one of these deemed compliant plants that, yes, it wouldn't be able to generate a RIN, and so it wouldn't be able to be counted for purposes of the volumetric mandate, but it can still sell its ethanol, and it's still fuel. Ethanol existed before.
Let's assume for a second that some plants would shut down. Won't there be fewer purchasers of corn then?
Well, not necessarily.
Therefore, their theory is fewer purchasers of corn, therefore the price goes down.
Not necessarily, Judge Kavanaugh, for two reasons. Number one is that grandfathered plants that are not using all of their existing capacity would potentially increase their capacity.
That could happen even if they're operating.
Well, it could, but they would have greater incentives to do that, precisely because they would then they would be able to generate RINs, and the price of the RINs would be higher because there would be a smaller market for RINs if these deemed compliant plants went off the market. So they would make up the existing capacity. I mean, there is a market here. It's driven by supply and demand, but there are two markets. There's the market for RINs, and then there's also still a market for ethanol that has nothing to do with the RINs itself. I mean, the United States was a net exporter of 1 billion gallons of ethanol last year. Now, that's a significant number, because 1 billion gallons is essentially the same, if not a slightly higher amount, than the total amount of the deemed compliant facilities added up. So none of them would necessarily have to stop producing. Even if there was no domestic market for them, they could just export their ethanol, and the domestic market could be met through other facilities. Maybe new plants would be built that meet the 20% reduction requirement. Right now, they don't have
that last one. You're suggesting that the deemed compliant plants would, if this were vacated, would just keep on going as is, even if they couldn't retrofit because they could export?
I'm saying they could. I don't know whether or not they would, but I'm saying they could, and therefore petitioners can't meet their burden. I'm saying that grandfathered plants might increase their output. I'm saying that new plants that use advanced technologies that meet the 20% reduction requirement might be built that otherwise wouldn't be built, and that would therefore have the same amount of corn starch being consumed as would otherwise be consumed. I'm saying that maybe refiners will continue to buy from deemed compliant plants, even if they don't meet the 20% reduction requirement, and even if they're not deemed compliant, because the price of crude is very high. And ethanol, if it's less expensive than crude, can be substituted in. And there may be.
That's not going to happen anytime soon, is it?
Well, Judge Kavanaugh, ethanol was produced before RFS1 or RFS2 existed. The point is, there's a laundry list of maybes here, and it's petitioners.
An issue there, but anyway.
And it's petitioners' burden. And I think also on the issue of causation is for them to show that the elimination of the deemed compliant effects will have any measurable effect on the price of corn, when if you look at the Simon Declaration, these deemed compliant plants represent something like 6% of U.S. ethanol capacity. I'm sorry, I thought there was another question.
I'm getting the feeling that you're saying that even if you don't do the 20% reduction and you're not grandfathered, that the ethanol plant just skips merrily along. I mean, there's got to be some. What happens if you're not in compliance? You don't meet the Clean Air Act definition, so then what happens? Are you paying fines? What happens?
Well, that's my point, Judge Henderson. You're not paying fines because this provision does not regulate primary conduct. It does not prohibit these plants from producing any ethanol, and it doesn't prohibit refiners. Well, no, Judge Henderson. What it does is it creates a volumetric obligation for refiners, and refiners can only use facilities that either are grandfathered or that meet the 20% reduction requirement in order to count towards their volumetric obligation. But there are other reasons these ethanol producers might continue to produce. Like I said, to export, for example, where RFS2 doesn't apply. Now, I'm not at all suggesting that ethanol plants would skip merrily along. There's a lot of things that could potentially happen.
They'd rather be in the RIN market.
They would rather be in the RIN market, absolutely, Judge Kavanaugh. And if they're not in the RIN market, my earlier point was somebody else already is, the grandfathered plants, who would have incentives to increase their capacity because what their current, or that is increase their output, because what they're currently putting out is related to what the market will bear right now. There's also an issue with respect to, with causation, with the petitioners ever establishing a direct link between the provisions that they are challenging and the harm that they are articulating. Because with respect to the harm they're articulating, they say RFS2 will cause this. The RFS2 is going to increase feed prices. But RFS2 covers not only all the grandfathered provisions that existed prior to December of 2007. It includes all of the new corn ethanol plants that could be built using these advanced technologies. And it includes a laundry list of other things as well. To simply point to the regulation as a whole and say that it's going to have an impact on feedstock prices, it doesn't meet their burden of showing that the challenged provisions will have an effect on feedstock prices.
That's not all they say. And well, they then go on to the specific, at least as I read their briefs.
Well, they say it, but the only things that they point to refer in the record, and that's all they have, is, again, they don't have affidavits, they don't have any evidence. The only things they point to refer to RFS2 as a whole and refer to RFS2 when it's operating at full capacity in 2022, not with respect to the deemed compliant provisions. If I may, what a couple words on the merits, and I recognize I'm on borrowed time. When you read the provisions in the transition rule, I think it's reasonable to read that first sentence as referring to fuel from 2008. Again, we're talking about having a RINs market. RINs are traded in later years. A RIN that's produced in 2008 can be traded in 2009. It could have been traded in 2010. I think you can read the first sentence when it says for calendar year 2008. It's referring to fuel from 2008. And if that's a reasonable way to read that sentence, it's also a reasonable way to read the second sentence when it says for calendar year 2008 and 2009 that's referring to ethanol plants from 2008 and 2009, which I think would support the construction that EPA has adopted, which is that if it commenced construction in 2008 and 2009. And to Judge Kavanaugh, your earlier question with respect to how long does it take to build an ethanol plant, the regulation itself, and I don't mean preambular language, I mean the regulation itself recognizes that construction can reasonably take as much as 3 years, and that's a JA 568.
Didn't it also say that it can be done within a year?
I think counsel just said it could be done potentially within a year. But what I was going to say, Judge Kavanaugh,
something on JA 390 that says can be done within a year.
In looking into this issue over the weekend, for what it's worth, I'm not aware of any ethanol plant being able to be built in less than 12 months. And I think the average is much closer to 24 months. That's significant, Judge Kavanaugh, because if you assume that an ethanol plant will take at least 12 months to be constructed, it means you read the word 2008 out of the statute in that second sentence. Because if it's going to take at least 12 months, then any fuel that's going to come from an ethanol plant that's natural gas or biomass fired in 2008 is going to be from a plant that either existed before the statute was adopted or had commenced construction before the statute was adopted.
You can't say it's going to take at least 24 months, though.
I can't say it's going to take 24 months for any and every ethanol plant to be built. But I can say that it would take at least 12 months, and that would read the word 2008 out of the statute for sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
How much time does Ms. Stetson have? Okay. Since they went way over their time.
Thank you.
You can have your 2 minutes that you have, that you are yours, and some extras if
Thank you
need
Judge Henderson. A word about burdens. It is our burden to show injury, and we've shown that, and EPA actually has shown it for us. I'd point you to Joint Appendix 385, which is the EPA's recognition of the impact on commodity prices of the RFS2. That includes causation. I'd also point you to Joint Appendix 1132 to 1137, which are the submissions by two of the country's largest turkey producers about the multi-million, in fact, multi-hundred-million-dollar impact of RFS2 on their costs. Now, for the to satisfy this constitutional minimum of standing
that's
that we're talking about,
that's
sorry,
the rule as a whole, though.
Correct, and that's my next point. We don't need to show catastrophic injury. We need to show some injury. That's what suffices for our standing. And I think, Judge Kavanaugh, to your earlier point, it's common sense that if you don't divert corn to whether it's 300 million gallons, 500 million gallons, or some gallon extrapolation of that that the deemed compliant plants cover, then our injury will be redressed at least in part. And that's also a constitutional principle. We don't need to show total redressability. We don't need to show that by addressing this glaringly deficient statutory interpretation, all of the costs that we have shouldered because of RFS2 will be instantly remedied. We need to show that that would address or redress those costs in part. And we submit we've done that.
Is that your strongest evidence that corn prices would go down if there were a narrower interpretation of the statute? In other words, is it just an Econ 101 kind of argument, or is there some evidence?
I think it's absolutely Econ 101, Your Honor. And, you know, to the earlier points about where our burden lies and what evidence we need to show, we have put in evidence that our prices, our costs, the costs of feeding our product, are directly impacted by the diversion of food to fuel. If you divert less food to fuel, our prices will go down. We don't need another affidavit on that, and we certainly don't need affidavits to support this sort of post hoc spiraling speculation about the other ways in which it might be possible for hypothetical other plants to retrofit or to come online and to step in to fill the 300 million or 500 million or more gallons of capacity that are impacted by this rule. Let me make one point on the statute itself. Judge Kavanaugh, you asked, I believe, EPA's counsel the question about the ambiguity between fuel and plant, how it could possibly be relevant to the calendar year issue. That's exactly the point. And I heard EPA's counsel concede, in fact, that in order for their interpretation to work, you have to read the word fuel into the statute, just as I said earlier. So if we're both offering competing interpretations, both of which have to read some word into the statute, we submit that our interpretation, which doesn't read additional words into the phrase for calendar year 2008 and 2009, the key phrase, is the interpretation you should go with, because that's the one that's plainly counseled by the face of the statute.
How about the intervener's argument, though, that it reads 2008 out because it takes at least 12 months to build one of these plants?
Well, I think in practical terms, Judge Henderson, I think that goes back to the colloquy that Judge Kavanaugh was having with EPA's counsel, which is this transition rule a mistake, or was it the product of what is likely, because of the entirety of this particular act, a hard-fought compromise? I don't think it's possible, and I think I heard EPA's counsel say there's no even legislative history available counseling toward or against the sort of practical impacts of this reading. What you, I submit, are left with is to read the statute as it instructs, which is for those calendar years, these particular plants will be deemed compliant, no more than that.
And if there aren't any in 08, there aren't any in 08.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
sorry. It's in the conference room.
Okay, so we'll just carry it.
All right, thank you.
Can you shut down her laptop?
Sure.